On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 2 hours yesterday morning on the grassy Virginia Tech campus, and America was changed. A massive shooting spree at the university resulted in 32 dead, 15 wounded, and one dead student gunman. The worst shooting in U.S. history. The scenes recalled by witnesses are unforgettable. Police pulling out wounded students, a hail of gunfire captured on a cell phone camera, scared students barricading a door. The event had echoes of other school shootings, but events in Blacksburg, Virginia yesterday overshadowed them all. This hour, On Point, Virginia Tech and the unfolding tragedy. Joining us now from Blacksburg, Virginia is A.J. Legault, anchor and reporter at WRIC, an ABC affiliate in Richmond, Virginia. A.J., so nice that you would take the time to be with us. Thank you.
Hi, Jane.
Tell us more about what you've learned about this shooter, Cho Sung-hui.
Well, obviously, the big news this morning, and they just wrapped up a media briefing, is, of course, the identity of the killer. As you mentioned, Cho Sung-hui is who police are saying is the gunman who orchestrated and carried out the massacre here on campus. He was enrolled as an undergraduate student in his senior year. He was an English major here at Virginia Tech. He was a resident alien, meaning he was here on a green card. His residence was actually established in Centerville, Virginia. And Cho was living on campus in the Harper Residence Hall. There had been some debate as to if it was a student, if it was somebody from off campus, but we do know now that he lived on campus.
And has been in the U.S. for some time, as I understand. His parents are still in Virginia, is that right?
My initial understanding. Have not really had a chance to confirm that.
Have investigators reconstructed the timeline of events yesterday, A.G.?
They have been working on a timeline basically since early yesterday afternoon. The original shooting, the original call to 911 came in at 7:15, and that was that there had been a shooting, and that was in one of the dorms known as AJ Dorm here on the Virginia Tech campus. When officers arrived there, they found two victims, a female student and a male RA, who had been murdered in a room there. Then it seems like almost 2 hours later, inside Norris Hall, which is a classroom and office building on the other side of campus, quite a ways away, shortly after 9 o'clock is when the real chaos broke out, when it actually turned into a massacre as opposed to what was originally thought to be an isolated domestic event.
I heard reports, AJ, that this gunman filed the serial numbers off of the guns that he used. He carried chains to lock the door shut from the inside of that dorm. Is there information that indicates if or for how long this shooter planned the attack?
There has been nothing said about how long he was planning it, but as you said, chains were carried. This wasn't a spur of the moment. This really appears that he had planned this out so that he could have that building isolated to do the most amount of damage in the shortest possible time without interference from law enforcement.
And do investigators know what he did during that two-hour period between the first shooting and the second shooting?
That's really the big unanswered question right now, is just where was he? Authorities originally had a different suspect in mind from the first shooting and had stopped that person off campus. He was not a student, the original suspect, and were questioning him when the shooting broke out at the in the classrooms.
What do investigators know about how he carried out this massacre? I heard this morning the shooter just went calmly from room to room at the second site. What do you know, AJ?
Investigators are holding their, or kind of playing their cards pretty close to the vest. Students, witnesses that we talked to, even one young man who was shot in the arm, kind of said he was walking and just blasting away, coming into different classrooms. We do know that I have to look at my notes, but I believe there were four classrooms. Yes, four classrooms and a stairwell where victims were found. So this was not all in one area. This was throughout the second floor of the building. And that's part of the problem with for investigators right now is they're telling us that the chaos and panic that ensued is complicated the processing of the crime scene. There's personal effects strewn throughout the second floor. Many of the victims, taking off in sheer panic, did not have purses, wallets, bags on them. So at this point, not even all of the victims have been positively identified.
And the firearms that were used, AJ, I understood that the shooter wore a vest with perhaps an extended clip. Can you explain more about the weapons that were used?
He was carrying two handguns, a 9mm handgun and a smaller caliber, a .22 caliber handgun. They were recovered from Norris Hall. They were with Joe and on his body when police found him. And this morning, they announced that the ATF has confirmed a ballistics match at both crime scenes.
So the first gun was used at the second scene.
One of the two. They didn't elaborate, but one of the two weapons, I don't know if that's the 9mm or the .22, was used at the first scene, and both were used at the second scene.
And the shooter went to some effort to conceal his identity. There was no identification found on his body, and the way he took his own life concealed pretty much his facial features. But there was some evidence on him that traced the records for the guns that he used. Is that right?
I honestly don't have an answer for that question
okay.
at this point. They came in, we had a media briefing where there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of rumors going around. I don't want to report something that's not accurate. And they took no questions today when state and local law enforcement addressed members of the media just a short time ago.
A.J. Legault, anchor and reporter at WRIC, the ABC affiliate in Richmond, Virginia, thank you. I'd like to bring in, from Blacksburg, Virginia, Suzanne Higgs. She's a sophomore at Virginia Tech, and she was in class yesterday and heard gunshots. She writes for Planet Blacksburg, which is the student newspaper there. Suzanne, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
Can you describe what happened yesterday morning, Suzanne, from your perspective?
I sure can. I was actually in class at 9:05, got up regular day, walked over. It was really cold and it was snowy, but, we've had wacky weather lately. And about 9:30, I checked the Virginia Tech webpage, and I saw that there had been a shooting incident at West Ambler Johnson, the dorm, and then I started, looking for people that I knew in AJ to see if they were okay, and then shortly after that, the department head and Shanks, our communication department head, came and told us to stay inside and lock our doors. And from there, it just escalated, and we heard the gunshots, I'm guessing from Norris, but we heard seven pops, and we all immediately moved over to the other side of the room.
I heard that the shots were slow and steady, almost rhythmically carried out. What do you remember from hearing them?
I just remember there were seven pops. I was on the other side of the room looking up on CNN and everything else, and I can't really tell you.
And looking around, what did the campus look like? Were people running? What was the sort of the scene there?
Well, I was inside, and I know that our professor looked outside, and, there weren't a whole lot of people in the upper quad. By that time, they had locked down our side of the campus and the other places around Norris, and McBride was locked down, and so we were safe where we were.
There was a heavy sense of quiet on the campus overnight, as I have been listening this morning. The memorial in the middle of the campus. Tell me what is going on there now, Suzanne.
Well, yesterday after, the campus was really quiet. There's no one on the drill field. And I know today there's still a somber, mood and atmosphere of shock. And I think everyone's just starting to settle in and figure out, people that weren't directly involved, that this did happen. And this is our town and our school.
I know your parents came down from your hometown nearby to be with you. It's a big campus, but a small town. It seems everyone knows someone there. Are you dealing with friends or others that you know that are injured or perhaps worse?
I personally don't know, but my boyfriend knows one of the cadets that was killed. So I'm thinking of him today.
You are a technology generation, and I know much of the students that relied heavily on email and text messaging and the internet to get information and to communicate during this period. Can you tell me about that, where you guys turned, and sort of how you connected with each other student to student?
Well, what happened was, as I started checking the website, and then, you know, I emailed my mom and my cousin and people to let them know I was okay with the first incident. And then as stuff went on, we didn't have a TV in our classroom, so we were constantly checking CNN. And actually, Planet Blacksburg meets in the classroom that I was in, our student organization news team. And so we were in there looking and researching and trying to figure out what happened and just trying to get updates on our website to keep the students informed and us. And that's pretty much what we were doing. Me and a co-person in our group of Planet Blacksburg, Trisha Sangalang, we were in that classroom for 12 hours yesterday.
Mm. Probably hasn't had a chance to sink in, really, but can you tell me sort of how you're feeling emotionally and how this has been affecting you and your friends?
Well, this morning it started to sink in more as I was reading comments and watching more of the video. And yesterday I was in reporter mode, but today I got to slow down. And, you know, I got a little teary-eyed, and I guess I'm still trying to block it out a little while longer.
Suzanne, thank you for being here.
Thank you for talking with me.
We're talking about the tragedy on the Virginia Tech campus yesterday and its meaning as the country digests this horrific and historic news. What we know so far, Virginia Tech senior from South Korea, Cho Sung-hui, was behind this massacre. Virginia Tech police this morning held a news conference. Police Chief Wendell Flitcham identified the shooter as from a student at Virginia Tech from South Korea.
We have been able to confirm the identity of the gunman at Norris Hall. That person is Cho Sung-hui. He was a 23-year-old South Korean here in the U.S. as a resident alien. Cho was enrolled as an undergraduate student in his senior year as an English major at Virginia Tech. Cho was in the U.S. with a residence established in Centerville, Virginia, and was living on campus in Harper Hall.
Also at the press conference this morning, Steve Flaherty, the superintendent of the Virginia State Police, said that processing the crime scene has been very difficult because of the chaos that happened during the shooting.
At the crime scene, that the personal effects were strewn about the entire second floor at Norris Hall. So it made it much more difficult for us to identify students and faculty members that were victims. Victims were found in at least four classrooms as well as a stairwell. We know that there were a number of heroic events that took place, students and faculty alike, within minutes of this tragedy unfolding. The gunman was discovered among several of the victims in one of the classrooms. He had taken his own life.
Also at the press conference, Superintendent Flaherty of the Virginia State Police said that he did not believe there were any other shooters.
It's certainly reasonable for us to assume that Cho was the shooter in both places, but we don't have the evidence to take us there at this particular point in time. We also have no evidence to indicate that there's any accomplice at either event, but we are exploring whether or not there was someone that may or may not have helped Cho at any point during his planning or during his execution of this particular event.
There's been a lot of talk today about if authorities and why authorities at the School of Virginia Tech did not secure the campus, shut everything down immediately after the first shooting. Virginia Tech President Charles Steger responded to that question.
I think it's very important that before you take these actions, you know what the facts are. It takes some time to do that. Based on that, I think we did everything we could based on what we knew at that time.
So joining me now from Falls Church, Virginia, is Dr. Stanton Samenow, a forensic psychologist and author of Inside the Criminal Mind. Doctor, it's nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jane.
Have you read anything or heard anything today that might give you insight into what happened yesterday?
No, I really don't think so. There's so much that is unknown. And really, all that I know is what anybody else knows about this specific event. Of course, I've been for 37 years evaluating and treating offenders of all sorts, people who have committed mass murder, you name it. I've been involved in evaluating such people.
Well, from your perspective then, can you ever fully understand what sets off someone like this?
Well, the key word is fully. I mean, it's very hard. Even when you spend dozens of hours, which I do with some of these people, to get inside their minds. But there is a mentality. There are features that are common to people who commit terrible, terrible acts.
What kind of a mind calmly regroups after one shooting, killing two people, then 2 hours later moves to another location and shoots 30 more?
A person who is very much in control of himself, a person who is very intent on what he's doing, a person who has the chilling capacity to shut off considerations of consequences to others as well as consequences to himself. You have to understand that this is a mind that once it decides to do something, it shuts out all other considerations and nothing intrudes, nothing interferes.
So you cannot automatically assume some sort of mental illness involved here?
Quite the contrary. I mean, I don't think one should assume anything, but at least based on my experience, the type of person who would do this would be very purposeful, very deliberate, would have thought about it a great deal in advance, fantasized, planned it. And this is a person who is, if you had a videotape of his life, I think you would see that he is a very controlling person who does not take frustration and disappointment well. The frustrations and disappointments that most of us take in stride, or maybe with some difficulty, this sort of person makes very personal. There is simmering anger at a world that does not suit him. This is a person who has unrealistic expectations of other people. And when something critical happens, the one thing too much, it's all or nothing thinking. And he himself feels as though he's being psychologically annihilated, and he's going to be in control, and he will take control.
So what sort of warning signs lead up to an act like this, Doctor? You don't just go from being a student to, you know, having a girlfriend and a job and a life to mass murder. What are the identifying clues leading up to something like this?
This is the problem, that these are people who often are very accomplished. They're very intelligent. They do not announce their plans and their schemes to other people. And so I think that it would be very, very difficult to spot these people in advance. There are a lot of people who are controlling. There are a lot of people who are difficult. There are a lot of people who have the idea of getting back at somebody that frustrates them or disappoints them. But this is the person who will do it. And more than likely, a person like this may have no criminal record at all. So it is very difficult. And I think we've been hearing this in some of the commentaries around the country. You know, what can you do to prevent it? Well, there's very little you can do to prevent it. You're certainly not going to have security at every classroom that a person goes into.
Dr. Stanton Samanaw, forensic psychologist, author of Inside the Criminal Mind. Stay with us for just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us from Princeton University is Catherine Newman, professor of sociology at Princeton University and author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
How premeditated are such acts? How long are they usually planned in advance?
In our research, we uncovered planning as far in advance as 9 months. That doesn't mean that happened in this particular instance, but school rampage shootings typically are planned. People actually do give off warning signals, contrary to what you've just heard, in part because their objective actually is to change the way other people think about them, and they're trying to pique people's attention, and they can't do that by a spontaneous explosion, so they do it by letting out hints and signals that something terrible is on the way.
Changing the way other people think about them, it seems that this person went to great lengths to try to conceal his identity, filing the serial number off of the gun, not wearing any identification.
I would bet that as we dig deeper into this case, we're going to find out that there are probably people who were aware that this person had something in mind, not likely the details, because it, in general, this is the kind of thing that school shooters have done in the past.
Well, talk about that. How is this this shooting different from past high school shootings that we know so well? For example, Columbine, where the victims, in this case, are a little older.
Remember that the shooter was only a year out of high school, and so the difference in age is not all that significant. I think the biggest difference is the physical setting of a university. It's just much more open and harder to protect as a result. In a high school, typically you have a single entrance and exit or perhaps two. and a very closed and age-bounded community. So in a high school, you have kids who are 14 to 18, and then you've got their teachers. But in a university context, anybody from the age of 18 to 70 could easily belong on campus, and you certainly wouldn't want to take anybody's dress as indicative of whether they belong. So it's more difficult to spot someone who doesn't belong, and typically, as the case in this instance, it is someone who belongs anyway. It's someone who lives there and who's part of the school community, and very difficult to spot for that reason.
How this shooting was carried out, does it lead you to any clues? Some students were shot once. Many students were shot multiple times. What does that tell you about the psyche of this person and what may have happened?
I think this is someone who set out with an objective to kill a lot of people and wanted to be absolutely certain they were really dead. He wasn't going to give them a second chance. And that suggests someone who, as your previous guest said, was full of rage and looking to go out in a blaze of glory. It is not uncommon for school shooters to be suicidal. It is not at all uncommon for them to want to put themselves in the line of fire, and they usually expect to be killed by the police. Sometimes they take their own lives. There is generally a history of a significant depression and difficult personal relations with others. That is absolutely typical of school shooters.
How does the fact that this was a recent immigrant and an Asian male change the conversation, if at all?
I'm not sure it changes it at all. There are many reasons why a young man could feel marginal or not socially accepted. Perhaps in this instance, it was his immigrant status, but and the vast majority of school shooters in the U.S. don't look like that, but they share in common with this person difficult social relations, a sense of being marginal and excluded, but not being a loner. They usually are people who are trying to join social groups, but they fail repeatedly, and so their daily social experience is one of rejection.
This happened nearly eight years to the day after the tragedy at Columbine in Colorado. We don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but are there incidents like this that are typically linked, some sort of sick commemoration of an anniversary, if you will?
There have been near-miss cases, meaning shootings that were on the way to being completed that were interdicted, where we know the shooter had a Columbine commemoration in mind. In order to know that there's a copycat factor here, we really have to know the shooter was aware of this and articulated or thought about it. We don't have any evidence of that in this instance, and my guess is it probably was not relevant, but it's very difficult to know with someone who's killed themselves. It's hard to go backwards in their lives without their cooperation.
Are there similarities, to your mind, between Blacksburg and Columbine? I know we don't know everything about what happened in Virginia, but from what you've heard, do you see similar patterns?
I don't know as much about Blacksburg as I would need to know to answer your question. I will say that typically the predominant pattern of school shootings in the United States, at least at the high school level, is that they tend to happen in socially isolated, geographically isolated small towns. And there's a reason. A kid who's not doing well socially, who is living in a very remote place, often feels like he's serving out some kind of life sentence. He's not going to be near a city where he could find another social group that might accept him. He's stuck in a small town that's highly stable, and people don't leave, so it feels like his life will never change. I would be very surprised if anybody would characterize Blacksburg that way. After all, it's a community of 26,000 students, so it's not a tiny, tiny town. But there may be some elements that are similar. I just don't know enough about it.
Are these shootings at our schools, are they an American phenomenon? Can you imagine this happening in Europe and Latin America?
Oh, it has happened in Europe. The worst shooting of all time before this was in Erfurt, Germany, which has extremely strong gun control laws, I might add. It's happened in Canada five times since 1975, most recently just last fall. There was a terrible shooting in Dawson College in Montreal. So I'm sorry to say that we are not unique. We, however, do seem to have a more pronounced or frequent problem of this kind. But we're not alone, unfortunately.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. I want to turn back to Stanton Samihow, forensic psychologist, author of Inside the Criminal Mind, to ask you about the sort of dehumanization process that must go on before an act like this. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, absolutely. I had said earlier that this person, the shooter, has the chilling capacity not only to shut off considerations of right or wrong or the immediate consequences to himself, but any elements of conscience. They are also simply shut off from consideration, and there is really no operative concept of injury to others. There's certainly no putting oneself in the place of others. These concepts are just not there, and I do agree with your last speaker who said that these people often have difficulties in interpersonal relationships precisely because they don't view other people as human beings. It's always about them. It's about what they want. They are controllers. And so, yeah, the victims are really not seen as victims at all.
And so this is someone you would not be negotiating with?
No, there would be no negotiating with this sort of person.
How do you interpret the murderer in this case taking his own life? Is that common, Dr. Samihau? And what does it mean about the killer? Is there sort of a quest for martyrdom or stardom has been mentioned here?
Well, I have had people say to me that if they got caught in whatever crime it was that they had been contemplating, they would kill themselves. They would either go down in a blaze of glory, and that phrase was just used by your previous guest, but also there's something else. Wanting to be in control, they're going to determine what happens to them, not the police, not the state, not anybody else. This is the last act of being in control, taking your own life.
Dr. Samihau, is there any security that can prevent this kind of rampage, this kind of an act? We talk about our schools have got to be safer. We've got to protect our kids. Is there really anything you can do from your perspective as a forensic psychologist who studied these criminal minds? Is there any way to protect against it?
You know, this is a dismal response to a very good question, and that is that I really don't think so. We are an open society. Campuses are open. And to react with massive expenditures on security, thinking that we might prevent something like this, I really don't think so.
So it's a matter of time before it happens again?
Well, it is. On the other hand, I think that with some cases, I said earlier that often these people do not announce their intentions, and I'll stick with that. And it's only after the fact that we can say, well, they were this, they were that, they were this, they were that. The previous guest said that people like this have depression and difficult relationships. Well, zillions of people have depression and difficult relationships, but they don't go out and kill a bunch of students. So again, the problem is after the fact, we can see it. The problem, again, is what can we do earlier?
I'd like to turn to the phones for just a moment. A lot of people are calling, waiting to join our conversation. Laura is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Laura, hello to you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What's on your mind, Laura?
Actually, I was just calling because one of the things you said was about whether we had some historical echoes, and I immediately thought about a March 14th explosion in my office building, where an ex-boyfriend of the receptionist that I worked with actually went into the elevator and blew himself up, and her too. Mm. And really just, the building was really damaged and, blew up part of the building and really damaged a lot of things. And this Virginia Tech shooting, the shootings are really bringing that back. I think when things like that happen, you don't really have time to process them. But I remember feeling a sense of just a violation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the Virginia Tech students feel, but I see them on the news and I hear them and I think, wow, that's a group of really put-together students. But I do remember when the news and the media were there at the building, we were all very put together and just kind of matter of fact. And I think after a week or two, and even just hearing this Virginia Tech news, you start to feel like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. What's going on in the world? And why does your space get violated so randomly?
Laura, thank you for your call. Dr. Newman, I'll bring you in on this. It takes a lot for a lot of people to deal with this, and sometimes a lot of time. Is that right, for it really to sink in and to appreciate what's happened?
It takes a very long time, and no one should expect that anyone is going to heal from this very quickly. When I did my research, it was 3 years after the fact, and these communities were still reeling Laura makes a very good point. There were really two events that happened here, and they're going to turn out to be related, but they are different. One was a shooting between known antagonists, an attack, you know, between people who knew each other, which is what happened in her office building. And the other was a much more anonymous act of random violence, which is even more frightening because there's no known dispute between the shooter and the students in the German class that he attacked. And it does shake everyone's sense of what's normal, what you can predict in your environment, and that is what makes it so incredibly difficult. I do think, however, there are prevention possibilities we should discuss when there's time.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Is there some sort of, then, you're saying post-traumatic stress almost for those who may be wholly removed from the situation at hand?
When these events happened at Columbine, it shook the entire nation, including people who were 100 miles or 1,000 miles from Littleton, Colorado. It rattles all of our sense of what's normal. It's, of course, most devastating for those people who have really lost someone and are at the epicenter of an event of this kind. For them, this never goes away. The rest of us eventually find a way to move on, and therein lies a tale, a very sad tale, of people who need to continue mourning and other people who are ready to put it behind them. And that is a very difficult adjustment to make.
Richard is calling from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just had a simple question. Based on the videos that I saw yesterday, I was wondering why the heavily armed police that you saw did not immediately assault that building in an attempt to stop the shootings. That was my question.
Thank you, Richard. Maybe Dr. Samenow, you can talk to, you can speak to that. Is there some
sort
of strategy that is used in dealing with minds like this to sort of, well, I don't want to say let it play out because a lot of people died, but can you speak to that?
I don't think so. I wouldn't even begin to second guess what the police did in this case, and I don't think that one can generalize to other situations. It is a good question, though.
Let me ask Dr. Newman a question you brought up earlier, Doctor. As we watch these events unfold, especially with our children, what should we tell our kids, our families? How much of this should we be letting them watch that we should be watching ourselves? And what specifically should we be telling our kids about what happened in Virginia?
Well, I think very young children should be shielded from this at all costs because it's too horrific and there's nothing they can do about it. I think for high school age students and beyond, there are some important lessons drawn from research. The first is that because rampage shooters often do actually let off clues, as I said, as long as 9 months in advance, it's important for kids who hear rumors or who are confronted with troubling comments to speak to their parents about it and to allow the adults in their community to try and take a look into those things. You know, 99 times out of 100, it'll be nothing, but one time out of 100, it might be something significant. And the greatest possible protection or prevention comes from those people who have information coming forward. I could go on at great length about why they typically don't, but I can tell you that in rampage school shootings, it virtually always happens that people let off signals of their intentions. But the people who receive the signals often don't come forward for all kinds of reasons.
Like what?
Well, for example, they don't trust that the adults around them will do anything, or they worry that their names will not be kept confidential, or they're not entirely certain what these comments meant because they're vague and ambiguous, and they don't want to come forward under risky circumstances to finger someone when the information is so ambiguous. Because there's a social cost to a teenager of coming forward across that DMZ that separates teenagers and adults. They don't want to be identified as the rat in the pack. But they need to be assured that there is someone in the environment who will listen to them and take what they say seriously and confidentially and investigate in ways that will not, as far as possible, finger someone for whom this is a prank or not a serious episode. In all the cases we've looked at, there were dozens of pieces of evidence that something horrible was on the way, but virtually never did anybody come forward to people who could have stopped it. Now, that changed after Columbine, and there was a sadly protective effect of Columbine, because for a period of time, several years, in fact, afterwards, when kids heard these kinds of threats, they did know it could be real, and they did come forward, and hundreds of near-miss plots were stopped. But they were stopped because someone came forward, not because they were able to identify somehow in advance the kind of person who will do an attack of this kind.
The Associated Press has released some of the victims' names, and it appears that three of the victims were professors. And I'd like to ask Dr. Stanton Samenow, forensic psychologist, clearly this shooter went after teachers in some form. Is there a pattern or a message that we take from this about who the victims are, even in rampage shootings?
You know, I don't think that you can generalize, and it isn't clear to me from what you're saying that the shooter particularly targeted professors. See, I don't know if that was the case or not, or if he just started shooting and he shot at anyone whom he could shoot at. So it's hard to say what was in his mind in terms of targeting professors.
Have any of the past political responses to such shootings resulted in any serious reforms, or should they in the future? I'll throw that out to either one of you, Dr. Newman or Dr. Samenow.
Well, there have been some important federally funded programs that have been a great help to many schools. For example, the grants that permit school resource officers on campus in high schools. School resource officers are what we might call soft cops. They're not part of the school system, they're part of the criminal justice bureaucracy, but their job is to hang out with students and be available to them as confidants if they're troubled about something. And some of the most important near-miss cases that were interdicted came because kids came forward to school resource officers, which they feel more comfortable doing often than they do to school personnel, because they do believe that they'll treat it more confidentially and be more proactive in investigation. That is very helpful. Some of the things that are very understandable but less helpful are things like building perimeters around schools. You'll notice that in this case and in most other cases, the shooter was an insider, not an outsider. There are outsider cases, of course. The Amish case most recently was an intruder into the community, but most of the time this is somebody on the inside whom a fence will not defend us from. So the other thing to know is that zero tolerance policies for comments, for verbal material, can be quite counterproductive, while zero-tolerance policies for weapons, of course, always make sense. But if you tell kids that we're going to react without nuance to any kind of offhanded comment or threat, it stops kids from who have information from coming forward because they don't believe that response is justified.
Let me bring in Marguerite, who's on the line. She's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Marguerite, hello to you.
Hi, Jane. Everybody's shocked by this. It's horrible, but I can't help but think that so many parents in all of our inner cities across the country are always full of fear for deaths of their children and of their neighbors. And but when we consider that we have 31,000 deaths last year and 30,000 every year, this is a terrible thing in our country because we have such easy access to guns. And even though this was an exceptional kind of a case, still, this is the kind of thing that is easy to perform in this country more than in other countries because they all have very strict gun laws, and we do not.
Marguerite, thanks for your call. I appreciate your thoughts. Let's go to Patrick in Danbury, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the line.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to make a comment that I think it's, you know, I've heard a lot about what the school could have done and, you know, because they have handled it better, and I find that very sad because, you know, you guys have talked about if this person is going to do it, they're going to do it no matter what, and that now there should be a grieving process, and also that kids, you talk about the rat in the pack, but we have to teach kids to not be indifferent and not be apathetic, and if they do know something, to take control and to realize they're doing the right thing. And I'll just take comments off the air. I appreciate the conversation, and I just wish my best for everybody at Virginia Tech.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Angelica is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Angelica, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
My question has to do with, or my comment has to do with nature versus, the question of nature versus nurture. I'm a parent, and I wonder what the doctors have to say about what a parent can do, and to, I don't know if we can avoid this kind of thing, but what a parent can do in raising their children, and what they can say or what they can do in the home front to avoid this kind of occurrence. I'm thinking about the parent of these people who, the gunman, for instance. I can imagine the guilt that the parent must feel at this time. And as a parent, I want to know if there's anything I can do and tell my children, perhaps communication with them.
Angelica, thank you. I'll turn the question to Dr. Semino and ask you to respond, Doctor.
Well, of course, you need to be the best parent you can be and try to communicate with your child and do all the things that we always tell parents to do. However, there is a certain type of individual who, even as a very young child, he is the one who chooses not to communicate. He is the one who rejects the parent before the parent ever rejects him. And I have written a book about trying to identify signs of this type of personality very early. Now, again, this is different from preventing mass murder, but it is to say that if you have a child who lies as a way of life, if you have a child who, instead of starting to consider others' feelings, becomes more and more intent on controlling others, if you have a child who takes the view that he is never at fault, it's always somebody else, we don't know if he'll be a future criminal or a mass murderer, but we do know that this is trouble. And so intervening very early, and I'm talking about even in the preschool or elementary years, parents, teachers, and others need to try to spot children with these patterns without identifying them as criminals, but just in the name of prevention.
Dr. Newman,
to help children become more responsible.
Thank you. Dr. Newman, your comment as a sociologist at Princeton University.
I think the saddest thing to notice is that the school shooters we studied came from good families and dysfunctional families. They came from abusive households and households that everyone in the community saw as the salt of the earth. They came from households with working mothers and non-working mothers. There is no pattern that produces a school shooter. The Secret Service has worked on this issue at some length, and they're in the business of profiling strange events and unexpected occurrences, and they came to much the same conclusion, which is that we are not going to be able to identify in advance the person who's going to do something like this. This is why, in my own research, identifying and making it easier for kids to come forward with information to their parents is so critical. I have to say that the school shooters for whom we have evidence, and the evidence often comes out in trial circumstances, which have their own liabilities, there is tremendous evidence of depression and early onset mental illness, often at an age where it's more difficult to diagnose. What does a schizophrenic look like at the age of 11? We know what they look like at the age of 20. At 11, it's a little bit harder, not impossible, but harder to identify. And so we often find, again, this comes out through trial transcripts or mental health investigations, that these are kids who are hearing voices in their heads, who are filled with rage, but they don't actually communicate this to others, or not in ways that are direct enough for them to come under a doctor's care or be diagnosed or labeled in any way. It's very rare, for example, for them to be medicated or in any way medically identified. And that makes the burden for parents very, very high, because if you have two kids and one of them is just a little bit different than the other, how do you know you've got someone on your hands who's really going to develop into a very troubled character? You know you've got two different kids.
I have about a minute left, and I'd like to give Dr. Semino the last word. Any last thoughts as we contemplate what's been happening the last couple of days?
Well, I don't think that making any kind of assumption that the person is mentally ill is warranted, and I hope that we're going to be able to learn a lot more about this individual. Of course, we can interview him, but if we can learn a lot more from others who knew him well, what indices, if any, that they found that he was a person who had severe problems, so we can learn from this.
I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Stanton Semino, joining us from Falls Church, Virginia, forensic psychologist and author of Inside the Criminal Mind. Doctor, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Professor Catherine Newman, joining us from Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey, author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Dr. Newman, I appreciate your time as well. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.